Welcome to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today Mark Weingartner, and we're going to be discussing The Godfather Returns, which is currently available in paperback, just released, and we're also going to be discussing Crooked River Burning, the novel that introduced me to Mr. Weingartner's work. So first of all, Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back in time a minute before The Godfather Returns. I discovered your work with Crooked River Burning, which is kind of a love song to Cleveland, Ohio, which is a place near and dear to my heart. And this was kind of a sprawling epic story of Cleveland. It starts in the 1950s and covers a lot of the history, the Indians, the Browns, and everything. And what was it about Cleveland, Ohio that originally drew you to Crooked River Burning?
Well, I moved there for a job in 1989, not necessarily thinking I would either love or dislike Cleveland. It just seemed like, you know, the place that went with the job. And as I, you know, gradually fell in love with Cleveland, I found myself thinking, well, what is it about this place? Why does this place speak to me so much? You know, I've often said that I'm not from there, but it's the only place I've ever lived that really felt like home. Mm-hmm. Even though I was born and raised in a little town, you know, my whole childhood was spent in one place, and yet I never felt as in sync with the place as I did in Cleveland. And, you know, I lived in Cleveland in the late 80s and early 90s when it had its little half-baked comeback, and I was fascinated with the idea of why, you know, Cleveland became such a laughing stock. And when I started to learn a little more about Cleveland history, just accidentally, I wasn't making a study of it at the time, you know, I started realizing that right after World War II, Cleveland was not a figure of fun to anyone in the U.S. If you see this in John Cheever, where if a Cheever character it can't work in Greater New York, the next best place would be Cleveland. It comes up, you know, at least a dozen different times. Chicago is the provinces, but Cleveland, because of the culture there and all the Standard Oil people that live there, among, you know, sort of middle class and upper class people in New York, Cleveland was, you know, sort of a satellite. And yet, you know, a generation after that, you know, the mid-century, Cleveland, you know, was a figure of fun. Then when I found out the people who started the Cleveland jokes were from Cleveland, that they were the head writers from Laugh-In, were both from Cleveland, and started that started to get me going. But really, it was the thing that made me see it as a book was a baseball game I went to with my friend Carl Keske, and Carl told me this story about being a kid, 12 years old in his case, unlike David, who's 14, who goes to Satchel Paige's first game in a Cleveland Indians uniform. And it was a really moving story to me, because, and to Carl too, a moving experience, because he grew up in a segregated part of the west side of Cleveland, and he went to this game as an exhibition game the day after the All-Star game with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and it was a sellout crowd. Cleveland Stadium was full, but there were only about 5,000 tickets that were sold in advance. And they sold out all walk-up sales, virtually all black. And it was the only experience that Carl had ever had in his life of being a minority. Well, they were all black because, or overwhelmingly black, because the Brooklyn Dodgers had become Black America's team. This is only 1948, only a year after Jackie Robinson. They had Roy Campanella by then. And Carl said to me this great line, you know, when people were, you know, first, everybody was rooting for Brooklyn, and it was, you know, he was a huge Indians fan, and that freaked him out. And then when Satchel Paige came into the game, there was this deathly silence as people slowly realized who it was that was warming up the bullpen, the great Negro League pitcher legend Satchel Paige, you know, of undetermined age,
right?
Signed by, you know, the great showman of the Indians, Bill Veeck, and everything turned, and the whole crowd, you know, after that you know, the silence that switched the momentum of that, you know, started. It just went completely crazy, and started, it was screaming for Cleveland. Paige came in and struck out the side, but Carl said to me, you know, it's wrong to, it freaked him out that people weren't rooting for the home team, and then he said, you know, but I realized all the different things that home can mean. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, that story just stuck with me, and I thought, you know, I thought for a couple of years I wanted to maybe write a short story that, you know, that used that, and or maybe a series of stories set about in Cleveland, about a kid growing up in Cleveland, and instead I wrote this, you know, 700-page novel,
yeah,
kind of an epic about Cleveland in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
And you really capture, because that was the peak time for the Indians. And
right.
Bob Feller was pitching there. And then you take us through the Alan Freed era of rock and roll. And you've written about baseball before, Veracruz Blues,
right.
And your musical knowledge is vast. And for those who have read The Godfather Returns but haven't read Crooked River Burning, I strongly recommend it because you catch a lot about the rise of rock
right.
and roll, Sam Shepard, and the fascination with the Sam Shepard case, which
right.
continues to this day.
Sure, it does. It was really one of the first kind of modern, maybe arguably the first modern media murder trial. And the people were obsessed with it in the same way that later generations of America would be obsessed with the OJ trial while it was going on. But unlike most of the other celebrity trials you think of like that, Sam Shepard wasn't famous going in to any of this, and yet I think most, but not all people think, but that Shepard probably didn't do it at this point. But it's still still unclear. But the preponderance of evidence certainly tilts toward his not having done it. And I used that murder as something to tie the whole book together, as a kind of cracked mirror reflection of the love story between the two main characters that drives the whole book.
So, Crooked River Burning is released, published by Harcourt. Life goes on, and then suddenly Mark Weingartner's life changes. And tell the listeners how this happened.
Sure. Well, Jonathan Karp, who I did not know when he first contacted me, had read Crooked River Burning and really loved it. And he contacted me one day and asked me to write a proposal to write a sequel to The Godfather. Right, exactly. Sure. And I couldn't figure out which of my college buddies must have been behind this nefarious practical joke. But, and my first impulse was, gosh, that's interesting and flattering, but it's not the kind of book that I write. And then, I thought about it for a while. I certainly wasn't leaning toward doing it. And then, I looked more closely at the email that John had sent me. It was really clear to me that Random House was serious about it being a serious book, that it'd have complete artistic freedom, and all they wanted was a good book, because the feeling was, the commercial interest in The Godfather was already there. The book didn't need to be in any way, condescending to the audience or anything. That people were interested in these characters automatically. So what was most important was that the book was good. And then I don't know why it never occurred to me, but why is it necessarily not the kind of book I write? If I wrote it, it would be the kind of book I wrote.
Right.
And that both The Veracruz Blues and Crooked River Burning had small but very important organized crime plot elements.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't, unlike Puzo, who'd never written about organized crime before he started The Godfather, I at least had a, running start. And the novel that I was working on at the time was going to be about the mob in Cleveland in the 70s. So it wasn't as if I hadn't been doing research, and learn a lot about it before that time. And so I wrote this proposal. In the meantime, John had approached two or three writers that he thought might do a good job, but somebody's agent leaked this to the New Yorker. So then it became this huge media frenzy, and they had hundreds of proposals, and including about three dozen from established writers and a few from intensely famous crime writers. But they wanted to give this to a literary novelist, and at the end of the day they picked me. So then it sent me on this, everything about this was exactly like writing any other novel for me, with one exception. It was, my earlier novels were written within a framework of historical fact, and in The Godfather Returns that fact is Mario Puzo's novel as well as the movies. I decided that I'd make it dovetail perfectly with the whole Godfather saga. The one difference was the deadline. I mean, they really wanted to have the book out by the end of 2005, or in 4, pardon me.
And when was this?
And so this would have been 2002 when they first approached me. So that's pretty fast for me. I'm a very slow writer. And, you know, I kind of wondered, well, where's the fire? And I definitely, I know for sure that if they, if they thought it was necessary to have that time, if they thought the book that I handed in was shoddy, they would have given me more time. But I ended up being a victim of my own work ethic, I guess, because I handed in the first 100 pages thinking that we'd have a conversation about pushing the deadline back, and instead they loved it, and they said, well, we don't see any reason why you can't be done. This is in great shape. And so I thought, well, what the heck? And I was, as fate would have it, it was just total dumb luck, but I was already set to have the first sabbatical I'd had. I teach at Florida State University, and I've been teaching for over 20 years, but I'd never had a sabbatical before, and that was already lined up for a project I abandoned to do this. So even though, Crooked River Burning is a long novel, and it took me a little over 4 years to write, The Godfather Returns, I probably spent more hours on The Godfather Returns. In the time that I was working on that, it was really just around the clock. I went away to artist colonies every other month the whole time I was working on it. It was just sort of like, just a monastery for artists and writers. And, and then the last 8 weeks I was working on the book, I literally slept every other night.
Wow. And The Godfather Returns is a wonderful novel, and you decided to focus on Bobby and his desire to become a legitimate family. Mm-hmm. How long did it take you from finding out, okay, I'm going to be doing this, to finding your storyline and your way into the story?
Right. Well, the thing in the when I reread The Godfather, looking for where another story could be. I wasn't going to write this book unless I thought I could write a good book. I wasn't even going to submit the proposal. But I was thrilled when I made a real study of The Godfather as well as the films, that the most important thing in the whole saga, the thing that Vito is yearning for, the thing that Michael is yearning for, the thing that's driving the story is Vito's and then Michael's desire to take the family business legitimate. This was totally unresolved anywhere in the saga. At the end of The Godfather, Michael's just taken over as boss, so of course it's not resolved yet. But at the end of Godfather Part 2, he's neither any closer nor any farther away from doing that. A lot of bad things happen to Michael personally, but the organization really isn't all that weakened by what's happened in Godfather Part 2. Godfather Part 2 ends in the late 50s. The present action part of that only takes place in about a six-month period of time. Godfather Part 3 begins in 1979. We know almost nothing that happens in all those intervening years. We see that Michael has been partially successful in making himself perceived, anyway, as being legitimate. There's no explanation for this. We have no idea how he got there. And yet, it's so central to the whole saga. I was thrilled to see that was still on the table. There were so many other loose ends. It was why Puzo gave his blessing to this project before he died. He had had a bad experience working on Godfather Part 3. He didn't like the way it turned out, and he was burned out on the whole thing. But when John Karp, who was his editor as well, talked to Mario about it, he said, he conceded that there were a lot of loose ends and plot holes in it, but he just didn't want to. He said, just wait till I die and find a good writer and get my family a lot of dough. Those were his stipulations, and so they did all that. For example, you see in Tom Hagen, the consigliere, played so memorably in the films by Robert Duvall, this sense, he's in, he's out, he's sort of their brother, but maybe he's just their lawyer, and you see this rising tide of frustration in Hagen about this, but it goes absolutely nowhere as a story. There were several other elements about that. The fact that they moved the center of the family business from New York to Nevada, something no real mafia family, by the way, ever did. But we never really, there's no explanation of how they would manage to pull such an unprecedented thing off. And there were other little things I just always wanted to see. In the Godfather saga, there's every sort of ceremony you can imagine, right? There's weddings, funerals, first communion, even papal honors, for heaven's sakes. But the one ceremony I always wanted to see is completely absent from the Godfather saga until the Godfather returns, and that's watching someone get initiated into the Corleone family. So now we see that.
Yeah. Did you work close with the Puzo family, or did they just give the blessing, and how did that work?
Yeah, they just gave the blessing. I mean, that was, if I hadn't known from the beginning that I would have complete artistic freedom, I wouldn't have been interested in it. And they were great. I didn't even meet anyone from the Puzo family until the day before the book came out. Yeah, we had I had lunch with Tony Puzo, who's Mario's son and the literary executor for Mr. Puzo's estate. But I met him for the first time, you know, what, probably 12 hours before the book was released.
So for the listeners out there, we all grew up with The Godfather.
Right.
What has this been like for you, being a guy from Cleveland, and not from Cleveland, but of Cleveland,
right,
and seeing all this, and now being part of the Godfather saga? Have you had a chance to even process this yet?
Yeah, maybe by now, just barely. I mean, it's been about a year. It certainly was a whirlwind. I mean, I turned the book in and finished all the edits, and less than a month after I was done with the edits for the book, I started doing interviews about the book. There was just no gap at all. So it definitely inhibits one's ability to have any perspective on the thing. And then, you know, it was a whirlwind. The book spent a couple months on the bestseller list.
Yes.
And you know, it was definitely hard to do anything other than just, you know, buckle my seatbelt and let the ride take me where it will. But, you know, I think I have what I was trying to do from the beginning with the book was to write, you know, a literary novel kind of in the sheep's clothing of a thriller, and I feel really happy about the way the book came out. You know, I've got enough distance on it now, and I've read enough from it at various public events, on book tour, and at readings like at the Swanee Writers Conference, and you know, I really feel good about just the way the art of the book, the
yes,
way that it came out,
yes,
and. You know, my motives, other than just writing a good book, which was about my only motive, really, but my other motives really were, you know, that I hoped... It's hard to be a literary fiction writer in America, you know?
It is.
And the, you know, I'd always had respectable sales, and my books had always been kindly reviewed, but there's, you know, I think any writer will tell you they have this anxiety that they think they might get to a point where their sales will... even if though they're solid, people think, oh, ho-hum, another, you know, well-reviewed, modest-selling Mark Weingartner novel, who cares? And you know, there is, sooner or later, you know, no one anymore is going to publish a writer because they think it's important. You know, they're going to publish the writer because they think that, you know, certainly in fiction, because they think they're going to make a buck off of it. And, you know, the opportunity to elevate my profile as a writer, too, you know, I certainly hope that people who read and like The Godfather Returns will, you know, and thanks for your kind recommendation, will turn to books like Crooked River Burning as well as to my future novels.
Yeah, absolutely, because, and I imagine there was probably a little envy amongst other writers, because this is kind of something that a lot of people would like to have happen to their careers, because the publishing world we live in is a very competitive environment.
Right. Well, in some ways, it's of our times. I mean, as wacky as my circumstances were with The Godfather Returns, how different is it really from what happened to writers when Oprah, you know, would pluck them and do that, or when you know, Marilyn Robinson, you know, won two major book awards last year, and you know, suddenly with Gilead becomes,
yes,
Gilead sold a lot of books, and you know, various kinds of things, whether it's,
yes,
awards or publicity or whatnot, can pluck a writer from obscurity.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, my feeling always is when things like this happens to other writers, I just want it to be a good writer.
Exactly.
You know, I can think of 20 or 30 writers who aren't especially well known who deserve something like this, and believe me, you know, when it happens to those writers, I will certainly not be jealous. I'll be, you know,
yeah,
applauding.
Absolutely, Mark. Where do you see yourself going from here? The Godfather Returns is now available in paperback. Where what should we expect to see from you next year?
I'm working on a novel called Smut right now. That's about the porn industry.
Really?
It's kind of, I've been playfully telling people it's going to be the All the King's Men of porn. you know, like All the King's Men, you know, it's based on Huey Long. It's based on a real guy who from Cleveland, actually, who literally did build the international porn industry as an industry. And, you know, it's a fascinating story about, you know, free speech and freedom and a lot of, you know, a lot of the things that people were arrested for in pornography in the 60s and 70s are things you can see on primetime television now, and certainly on cable. And, you know, these people were persecuted for things we don't even now consider to be crimes. But it's also kind of a great, I always love those books like The Great Gatsby or All the King's Men or Moby Dick that were, the great man story as told by the foot soldier. Just as a reader, that's almost always been, one of my favorite sorts of books. And so, the opportunity, it seems to me it's a good advice for any writer to write the kind of book that he loves in the hands of others. So that's what Smut's going to be.
That sounds great. Mark, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us today. Best of luck with The Godfather Returns in paperback, and we'll all be looking very anxiously at what comes down the road with Smut and other Godfather books as well, if that's the way the gods play it out. So thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome.